Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Mahalo for joining us here on The Conversation, Hawaii Talks. Sensitive subject, on the Big Island, a resident donating millions to worthy causes is scrutinized for his land purchase in an NPR story. The community pushes back. And counting the days, Wailua families and businesses tied to a water system at the Dillingham Airfield met for the first time since the state announced it will turn off water to the area in July. It comes as the YMCA's Camp Erdman will be in the middle of its busy summer season, serving 250 children a day. And it is Tsunami Awareness Month. We consider the added risk of climate change and rising sea levels. You're listening to The Conversation here on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. A recent NPR story about billionaire and Salesforce founder Mark Benioff purchasing land in and around Waimea created waves throughout the Big Island community. The story was titled, "A Tech Billionaire is Quietly Buying Up Land in Hawaii. No One Knows Why." It was written by NPR reporter Derek Kerr. After it was published this past February, a companion audio piece was broadcast in March. HPR is an affiliate of NPR, and naturally we began to get feedback from our listeners. And Sandler wrote, "I was one of the people that did not like the first article that came out regarding Mark Benioff. I thought it was quite biased, and so did several of my Hawaiian friends. Mahalo." Sarah Anderson also sent an email that read in part, "As a more than 40-year resident of the Big Island, first in Waimea, and since 1985 Honoka'a, I feel like her approach was not at all fair. There were presidents of wealthy people who fall in love with the island and then invest in it. It is called philanthropy. As you know, many Big Island citizens work very hard to maintain our unique culture and realize the benefits of the modern world. That balance is not easy, and someone with money who recognizes and appreciates the island should be heard and deserves our aloha." We also received feedback from listeners who felt there were still more questions than answers.
"Hi, my name is Peter Pomeranz from Kapa'au. Hi about the Mark Benioff story. I didn't feel it was necessarily negative, although there were some points and truths that were disturbing, like what wouldn't answer questions about what he's doing with these properties. And I think it's an important conversation for the community to be involved in, and I very much appreciated the article, and I'm not passing judgment yet, but I do have a lot of questions, and I think people do. Thank you."
And Waimea-born Hans Peter Fay says, "I will just share one quick comment that I shared with folks that have asked me for my reaction to these purchases, and that it is complicated. We try to make these into black and white issues, but like many things on Hawaii Island and anywhere for that matter, it's complicated. Is he buying up large tracts of land? Sure. Do we know exactly why he's buying those tracts? I know some of those homes were given to a private school in Waimea for faculty housing. His philanthropy is notable. We now have fire equipment and a second helicopter that we didn't have before, but which were sorely needed in the area. We have the potential for significantly increased medical care on this island. Again, something that is sorely needed. I have many friends in Waimea, and they're definitely split between those who think he's a wonderful philanthropist and those who think he's a greedy mainlander coming to ruin our way of life. Again, it's complicated." You know, and thanks to everyone who shared their thoughts via our talkback line. But we didn't only just hear from listeners. The Conversation's Raza Subiona grew up in Waimea and spoke to several residents who felt that Kerr's pieces didn't tell the whole story.
"We just feel that there was ill intent with the article coming out. It seems mean-spirited."
That's Waimea resident Shardé Lopez. She, along with her mom, Jessie Grace, were some of the first people to reach out to me after the NPR article was published. In fact, Jesse's first message to me read, "Shardé and I, plus a few more natives of this land, would like to talk story with you. We prefer to be named in your article. We have nothing to hide." Both are Hawaiian and have lived in Waimea for several decades.
"They do a lot of philanthropy type things that they go anonymous for various reasons. You know, they're not about the press. They're not about the media. They do it because they're just really kind people."
Yeah.
"And I think that's what hurts the most is knowing them on a personal level and knowing that the things that people claim to think that they're going to do with this land is probably the farthest thing they have from their hearts.
Sade's mother, Jessie, says she first met Benioff years ago when she worked at the Mauna Kea Beach Resort and he would hold conferences for his staff there. Sade became familiar with Mark's wife, Lynn, through coaching the Benioff's children on a local school sports team. Both Sade and Jessie took issue with the NPR article, especially the headline, "A tech billionaire is quietly buying up land in Hawaii. No one knows why." Jessie says she questions the intent of the article and doesn't see how it benefits Waimea. To her, it's a stark contrast to the Benioffs, who recently donated 280 acres of land in Waimea to an affordable housing nonprofit.
So my thing is, there is definitely a housing issue on this island. The state of Hawaii knows it. The county of Hawaii knows it. All of our Hawaiian entities know it. And when I say our people, I mean people of the Aina. We all know that this problem exists. And guess who finds a solution, or at least makes an effort to find a solution? And that was Mark Benioff. He purchases this land, he donates it, and works through a nonprofit. As far as I know, no one has done that. I just wish people would look deeper into it and really not take the face value of that article.
Sade says there were several issues she took with the NPR article. One is lumping Mark Benioff into the group of recent billionaires who have bought large tracts of land in Hawaii in the past. People like Larry Ellison, who owns 98% of Lanai, Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg, who has a large parcel on Kauai, and Amazon founder Jeff Bezos, who owns a beachfront mansion on Maui. Another is the idea that the community is worried that there is an ulterior motive behind Benioff's land purchases. She claims it's quite the opposite.
No one that I've seen in the community, been in the community, I've had people come to me and be, what is this? Why are they talking about the Benioffs like this? You know, more on the lines of defending them and shocked that someone would want to shed a negative light on this family. And one thing I think is something my mom and I have discussed in length is that there's a lot that this family does that no one knows, like philanthropy wise and contributions, donations to various schools, hospitals, other entities here, nonprofit entities that you'd never know because they're not in it for the clout. They're not trying to get recognition for all the things that they do. They do it because it's pono. They do it because it's the right thing to do. And that is what I think people are missing, is that we have so many problems here in the state of Hawaii, housing, education, the rising cost of living, and all of those type of things. And Mark is just one of those that has the resources to do the right things within our community to uplift the people of this land, to uplift the Native Hawaiian community, the people that are currently living here. And he's doing that. And I just don't see why the negativity around it. 90% of the land that he bought since 2020 has already been donated or gifted or something. If someone with negative intentions or sketchiness, right? If there was something sketchy that was going to happen, do you really think he would buy up that much and then give away 90%? It doesn't math for me, right? The math isn't mathing. It doesn't calculate in my brain. And the community, to me, have been very supportive of the Benioffs. And like I said, and shocked by the article and the light that it showed on the family.
After talking to Sade and Jessie, they put the word out to their network that I was interested in talking to people who felt the NPR article didn't tell the whole story. That led to me getting several texts and calls from people wanting to share their thoughts, including a longtime pillar of the community who has had a significant presence in my life. He only calls if it's important, and he called me twice, but also said I couldn't use his name. But thanks to Sade and Jessie, I did talk to someone who was willing to say the same things on the record.
You know, the notion that the Benioffs came and bought up all this land and changed the market in Waimea. That's just not accurate.
That's Nancy Carr-Smith. She's been a real estate broker in Waimea for over 30 years. She's the president of the Waimea Community Association, and she was also appointed to represent Hawaii Island on the State Land Use Commission by Governor Green last year. She's not tight with the Benioffs by any stretch, but she is working with Lynn Benioff on a community project. Among the issues Nancy had with the NPR article, the fear that the Benioffs buying land in town added to already sky-high housing costs and would price locals out.
COVID changed the market in Hawaii, in our district, and in Waimea. So when COVID hit, the market died for a little bit, and then people started showing up. They felt safe here. We're a friendly state. People often work remotely. And so the thought that they could come and live in Hawaii during this pandemic, enjoy the weather, I think all of those things combined, and that's why people were coming in droves, sight unseen. It was a very uncomfortable situation for me as a real estate broker of 30 years. So that's what happened. The demand was up. The prices were going up because of that.
I also talked to Nancy about what University of Alabama law professor Susan Pace Hamill said in the audio companion to the NPR article that, quote, owners of property hiding behind an LLC, they don't want to be outed as the owner of the property. Otherwise, they wouldn't have bothered to set up this wizard behind the curtain strategy, end quote.
Most investors use LLCs to buy property or trusts. It offers them asset protection, tax benefits, and forming an LLC is a smart thing to do. So, you know, I can only imagine that the Benioffs have, they have a lot of different LLCs. They probably have little pockets of this name and that name, and various properties are within each LLC, and that's how they likely manage them. It's no mystery. It's no way of hiding. If these people were hiding, they wouldn't be doing anything for the community. They would just be keeping to themselves.
As for the NPR article's headline stating no one knows why Mark Benioff is buying up land in Hawaii, Nancy has a theory.
I guess we know why, because pretty much 90% of what they've purchased since the pandemic has been donated. And almost 75% of what they've purchased over the last 25 years has been donated. And those are facts that I got from their organization. They've been very generous to our community. We're so lucky to have someone like this in our community. I mean, we have fire trucks and helicopters and rescue boats and land for affordable housing and money to improve hospitals because of them. How anyone can be anything but grateful is beyond me.
That was part of a conversation that HPR Russell Sobiano had with Waimea community members about NPR story that looked at billionaire Mark Benioff buying land on the Big Island. We'll continue our coverage after a break.
Support for HPR comes from the Scheidler College of Business at UH Manoa, celebrating 75 years, offering the global MBA with 21-month, 24-month, and 36-month options. Scheidler.hawaii.edu.
I'm Bert Lum. Today on Bite Marks Cafe, we find out how the online shopping site called Hawaiiverse has evolved coming out of the pandemic. We'll talk with the founder of the local e-commerce site to find out what techniques drive traffic to the site. That's this evening at 6:30 on Bite Marks Cafe.
Let's return to our conversation with Big Island residents about a recent NPR story. It was about Salesforce founder Mark Benioff. When we left off, Waimea real estate broker Nancy Carr-Smith mentioned her appreciation for the donations the Benioffs have made to the community, land for affordable housing, money to improve hospitals, as well as fire trucks and helicopters.
We know about the land donated for affordable housing, and the money to improve hospitals is a reference to the $150 million that Benioff's donated to Hawaii Pacific Health, $50 million of which are for improvements at Hilo Medical Center. But Nancy also mentioned fire trucks and helicopters. When I asked about that, she recommended that I reach out to Frank and Laura Sayre, the husband and wife team that run the Daniel R. Sayre Memorial Foundation.
Can you hear us?
Hi, good afternoon.
Hi. Well, how are you?
All right. I'm doing well. How are you guys doing?
Well, we're doing better now that we've got the Zoom figured out.
Awesome.
The Kona-based nonprofit was started in 1997 and is dedicated to providing essential equipment and training to the Hawaii Island Fire Department. It's named after their son, who lost his life in a tragic hiking accident. They formed the foundation to show their gratitude for the firefighters who risked their lives to retrieve their son's body from a secluded valley. They first met Mark Benioff about 7 years ago, shortly after a fire threatened his home.
When we first started working with Mark was in 2017. His agent at the time came to us and said, you know, Mr. Benioff is very grateful for the firefighters saving his home. They had literally fought a fire away from his home with their backs to his wall on his doorstep. And I mean, it literally came right up to his house and they didn't give up. They just kept fighting the fire.
Laura says to show his gratitude, Mark Benioff bought the department a big dog tanker truck. It's a massive vehicle capable of carrying 1,200 gallons of water across rough terrain like lava fields to fight brush fires. After seeing the truck in action, Benioff bought HFD two more, which were used during 2021's Mana Road fire, the largest in Hawaii Island's history. In the years since, he's purchased more vehicles for the department.
So then he, by some chance, was at a trade show and saw some of these beautiful tanker trucks, smaller brush fire tanker trucks on the showroom floor. So he bought two of those right off the floor and gave one to the Waikiki Volunteer Station and one to the Waimea Volunteer Station. Their fire trucks were hand-me-downs that were hand-me-downs that the Army gave to the fire department, and the fire department used them and then gave them to the volunteer stations. So the need was huge. And these guys, the volunteers, fight right alongside of the paid firefighters in putting out these fires. And if it hadn't been for the volunteers during the Mana Road fire, and also this most recent one was on the same day that Lahaina burned down, we would have lost structures. And so if it hadn't been for the big trucks that we had, plus the volunteer trucks at that time with the Mana Road fire, Waikoloa and Waimea probably both would have burned down. And we know from this last fire, Mauna Kea would have burned down had it not been for those trucks. So it's huge that he has, number one, gifted us with these trucks. He's now gifted us with four more. We have four coming in addition to the four we just dedicated.
In addition to the dozen or so firefighting vehicles, the Benioffs also donated two helicopters to HFD. One to replace an aging chopper that was repeatedly breaking down, and a second with the ability to transport critical care patients to Oahu. Altogether, the Sayers estimate that the Benioffs have donated over $27 million worth of vehicles and equipment to save lives and property on Hawaii Island. They say his generosity, not insinuations about his land purchases, should be the measure of his character. They also said they spent 4 hours with the NPR reporter who wrote the article, but their side of the story was left out, adding to the list of reasons why they took issue with it.
My first response to the article was disbelief. The second one was total disappointment. And my third one was, I felt like a mother lion wanting to protect my cubs. You know, how dare they? How dare they say this about my friends that I know are good people, who are doing wonderful things out of the purity of their heart? How could they do that? You know, I just really made me upset. And then it's painful for them. They try to do really good things and they don't talk about it. They're good, good people. And I'm personally very grateful they're here. I'm grateful that we get to partner with them and be a part of the bigger vision.
I don't know, this is a generalization, but in my experience, I've never come across an individual, a family, an organization, or a governmental agency that has done as much positive work for the people and the islands as those two have. Like he said in his remarks at the hospital, you know, that the hospital is a $100 million project, and there have been other $100 million projects down here, but they've been hotels and they've been golf courses and they've been commercial ventures. There's not been a philanthropic for the good of the people.
While talking to the Sayers, they mentioned Mark Benioff's generosity with Hawaii County at the onset of COVID in 2020. They claim he reached out to then-Mayor Harry Kim to ask what the county needed. Benioff reportedly responded by bringing in plane loads of masks and other PPE, along with COVID tests and later vaccinations. The Sayers also said few knew about those donations because Mayor Kim was sworn to secrecy. So I reached out to him to see if he would talk by phone about his interactions with the Benioffs. And to my surprise, not only did he accept, but he had been waiting for the opportunity.
Well, I really, really appreciate that opportunity, not for my sake or your sake or the station's sake, but for the Benioff's sake and the community, obviously.
Former Mayor Harry Kim served three terms, from 2000 through 2008, and then from 2016 to 2020. Prior to that, he served as Hawaii County's Civil Defense Director for 16 years. He started our conversation by reading a recent letter he had written to the newspaper. In it, he detailed the origins of his relationship with Mark Benioff and his donations to Hawaii County during the pandemic. Mayor Kim said that he had been sworn to secrecy, but after the Benioffs made their donation to Hilo Medical Center public, he felt released from his commitment to silence.
A phone call in early 2020, initiated by Mr. Benioff, was made to offer planning and financial assistance to Hawaii County government in responding to COVID-19. The offer was received with a lot of skepticism, as I have never heard of this person. That one phone call began a relationship of trust that resulted in planning assistance, 1 million face masks, development of a mobile testing and treatment system, airport screening program, public education activities, and other things. I so well remember Mark Benioff's request of no mention of his involvement in any way. When asked why, he simply said the ability to help keep Hawaii Island a nice and safe place was enough.
Mayor Kim said during his time in office, he met with many wealthy people wanting to move to the Big Island or start a business there. Having worked with Mark Benioff through one of the most difficult times in recent history, it seems Mayor Kim was in a unique position to assess Mark Benioff's character.
I begin to notice of his use of certain kind of words. And what he said is, Larry, nothing is more important than the health of our community. And he used the word our community. And I found out much later, though, that he was a member of our community because he moved himself and family over to Waimea. As you know, of my previous jobs, et cetera, I've dealt with many people of different levels, and many of them, and I hate to say, but most of them, if they come here, it is to make money. But this is the first person in just talking on the phone, when he's used to talk about the love of the culture, recognize the value of the culture, and recognize of himself honoring that culture. And I realize one very, very real thing. If we are lucky in this world, you know, the special gift will come to you. And I realize that Hawaii Island, a special gift has been given to us. This is what I feel about this person and his wife.
So knowing the Benioffs the way he knows them, how did he feel about the NPR article? Mayor Kim says he was disappointed with it, and he felt it instilled distrust in the community. But while these voices paint a broader picture of Mark Benioff and perhaps shares a side of him that didn't go into depth in the NPR article, there still remains one voice that I haven't talked to that could provide the clearest picture of who the Benioffs are and why they've bought land in Waimea and given to the Big Island community. So Mark, if you're listening, give me a call. I'd love to talk.
That was the conversation with Russell Subiono. He was talking to former Hawaii County Mayor Harry Kim and Big Island residents Sharday Lopez, Jesse Grace, Nancy Carr Smith, and Frank and Laura Sayer. They were discussing a side to Mark Benioff they felt was left out of a recent NPR story about his land purchases and donations. Waimea ikarua o ka paua kaiko I luna o ka. This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, your backyard quiz. Unihoa ulehua unihau ukaua uahu umulokai ulanai umau ukahoolabe uhawaii. Today we're heading to a popular destination on Oahu, Ala Moana Beach Park. The park and the adjacent Magic Island bustle with activity. Beachgoers, joggers, sports players, and picnickers enjoy the area on any given day. Before renovations, the popular McCoy Pavilion hosted concerts and cultural festivals. The grounds were well kept today, but the area looked very different in the last century. In the 1920s, wetlands filled with sedge plants, kiawe, and coconut trees made up what is now beach. Back then, the city used the area as a garbage dump. By the 1930s, cleanup and development of the area as a public park was underway. And in 1934, President Roosevelt participated in the opening ceremony. The beach has been officially called Ala Moana since 1947. But did you know that Magic Island is not the actual name of the 30-acre peninsula adjacent to the beach? For today's quiz, can you tell us its official name? Call 808-941-3689 or toll-free 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right gets a reusable tote bag from HPR.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from Nereid Hawaii, which supports nonprofits providing access to affordable housing to those with intellectual and developmental disabilities, including ARC of Maui County. NereidHawaii.com.
Imagine inviting 250 children for a summer camping program and the water gets turned off. Well, that's what the YMCA is facing come July. State transportation officials sent a letter this month giving tenants of Dillingham Airfield and users on its water system notice that it can no longer supply drinking water after July 6th. We talked to YMCA President and Chief Executive Officer Greg Weibel shortly after he met with stakeholders yesterday. It's a very complicated water arrangement. Users also include the State Forestry Division, which has a plant nursery on the line, as well as a spigot at the entrance to Kaena Beach Park. The city and county also has a Wailua Beach Park as well. But here's YMCA's Greg Weibel explaining his predicament.
We have 15,000 kids that come to the YMCA. During the summer, it's a pretty consistent 250 kids a day. But during the school year, we have lots of school groups that come out for environmental education. We have retreats that come out, et cetera. So we're busy all year round. But yeah, summer is a special time for us where kids come and stay for week-long for overnight camp, and then we have a day camp that's going on as well. So what are we going to do? So great question. The first thing is we're asking for some more time. So really asking the DOT and the state in general, as well as the Army, hey, look, you told us on April 10th that this water was going to potentially be shut off on July 5th. Like, that doesn't give anybody enough time to come up with viable short-term or longer-term solutions. So our first request is, please, like, let's not do this in 60-some days from now. give us some more time. And then second is, yeah, let's work on some longer-term solutions. I know the focus has really been on getting the airport lease sorted out, et cetera, and they've been working hard for years and decades, et cetera. I think the water has been, and they would say that, has been not the focus. And so now it's become the last thing to sort through and to come to good viable solutions. And it becomes a little bit broader conversation of, you know, the YMCA, we're the largest water user of the system. The airport and its users, I think, are the second. But there's another almost 20 additional users on the water line. And we all need to be involved in the conversation as well as the right solutions that make sense for all parties involved.
Right, because aren't we talking about, like, the beach park over there? You've got some homes.
Yeah, and there's some other government entities that are part of it as well. So the DLNR at kind of Point State Park, you know, has a spigot that they use for watering, and DOFA has a nursery, and then, yes, the city county park. And, you know, some of them also weren't even really aware, and they haven't been engaged in the conversation, and the users in general haven't been directly engaged in this conversation. And so it's really been rung upon us a little bit in terms of the urgency. I think there's been this awareness that there needs to be solutions, but the urgency, literally with a letter from DOT on April 10th with a deadline of July 5th, is just really short term.
And aren't there families also that are on this water, residences?
Yes. Yes, there's individual residences. And, you know, one of the things that, you know, I'm learning about some of this, but some of the history of these families is this land used to be originally not part of the federal government. The federal government took over in the 20s and really cut off the water supply, which used to come from the mountains. And so there wasn't kind of this, you look historically, there wasn't a need for these water systems. The water came from the mountains. And so all of that became impeded with the federal government, the Army, taking over the ownership of the mountains and ultimately cutting off the water to these families, et cetera. There needs to be some historical context of understanding, like, how did all of this come to be? And the consideration of, here we are today, what are we going to do to, you know, honor that past and understand that and come up with solutions that can work for all of us. So for the very first time, I just got off a call that was organized by Representative Peruso that invited all parties to the table for the first time to have this conversation. And we started the call with that of, come on, like, what? We've never been engaged as all of us into this conversation, and it's high time we do that. And so it was Representative Peruso kind of brought everybody together, the Department of Transportation, the Army representatives, as well as the user groups. And we were all appreciative to at least be included finally in the conversation and then talking through the solutions and where we're at, et cetera. So
you just had this meeting now? You just had this meeting today?
Yeah, it was just right before this call.
You're kidding. Oh, my gosh.
I speak the truth.
So what can you tell us? I mean, what's the path forward?
Very unclear. There's some legal challenges that different folks have to sort through, of which we've been become more aware of. The DOT's challenges of they can't operate a water system because of their requirements that they've gotten from the FAA. They're proposing this community cooperative, if you will, that we should take over the ownership and management of the lease with the Army. And there is some broad variety of questions about what would that look and how would that work, especially with some state entities as users of that. And they don't know if they can be part of the cooperative or not. So these are like really big questions and fundamental to being able to point to solutions that could work. the solutions are not realistic to think that we're going to get them done in 70 days from now. Like, they're going to take some time.
Was the state DOT willing to give you more time or not?
Well, that was the second part of the conversation, was Representative Peruso asked if DOT and the Army would consider extending some timeline so that we can have time to sort through and solve this. Representative Peruso said that we're going to schedule our next meeting, and by the next meeting, we should have that response from them. Is that possible, or what are you going to do, et cetera, because that's a critical question.
In a pinch, I mean, can you have water brought out to you?
Of course, we're working on that as our backup plan as well. What would that look like? Our water consumption on a daily basis probably means that we would have to have some kind of storage tank, and then we'd have to get it from that tank into our water lines to service our needs. We cook for the kids, their, you know, water consumption needs and showers, sanitation, et cetera. So we're exploring that feverishly on the other side. And again, some of this is going to take a little time. You know, is there a water tank the size that we need on island? How long would it take to get that done? We'd actually need to get Department of Health to certify the plans, and they generally say they need up to 60 days to do that. And then we're investing at least hundreds of thousands of dollars to put a system in place, temporary, or, you know, to serve just our own water needs. And then, of course, there's the cost in figuring out where would we get the water from to put into the storage tank and into our system. So we're working on that. I have a hard time getting that all done by July 5th, but we're sorting that out as well.
That was a conversation we had with Greg Weibel, CEO of the YMCA. We talked to him yesterday afternoon. He is scrambling to keep water in the tap for Camp Erdman this summer. A second meeting with water users is planned for next week.
Retired Supreme Court Justice Stephen Breyer. His reverence for the court prevents him from criticizing it directly, but he does have strong words about textualism, the philosophy dominating the court today.
Just looking at the words, just seeing what they meant to a reasonable observer at the time they were written, if we follow that approach, we're going to have a constitution that no one will want.
Justice Stephen Breyer joins us on the next On Point.
Beginning this afternoon at 2.
A teen is killed after a high-speed car chase with police. Their report raises questions.
Well, whatever the cops are saying, didn't seem right at all.
Then the police department shuts down without an explanation.
There was a life taken, and you closed everything down without giving the family any answers.
Police accountability and Crow Nation on the next Revealed.
Beginning this evening at 7.
Has a long and sometimes deadly history with tsunamis, and as we mark Tsunami Awareness Month, we look at the history of our warning system, as well as the need to revamp it because of the added risk of rising sea levels. HPR reporter Savannah Harriman-Pote joins us now. Good morning, Savannah.
Good morning, Catherine. Good to be on.
Yes, so the whole idea, if the sea levels are rising, I mean, this really means these waves can do more damage as they go inland.
Absolutely. So that is the concern. And this is an instance in which researchers are really looking forward to try to predict the risk that sea level rise is going to add to tsunamis. But when you think about how we've adapted to tsunami risk in the past, all of our research comes from looking backwards. So we want to know how tsunamis have impacted us throughout history in order to predict what would happen if we were to see a tsunami anywhere in the Hawaiian Islands. And so the start of our warning system occurred almost 80 years ago, and it actually was in April, because one of Hawaii's most serious tragedies was on April 1st in 1946. And I talked to Laura Kahn. She's the director of NOAA's International Tsunami Information Center. And she explained how our first tsunami warning system came about.
You know, that's in large part because from 1946, it was an event from the Aleutians, a magnitude 8.6, hit us in about 4.5 hours. We had no tsunami warning system, and so 158 people statewide perished. So that was the start of what we call our warning system. And between 1946 and 1964, we had, what is that average? I don't know, 5, 6, 7 years. Every few years, we would have one of these destructive tsunamis hit us from the Northwest Pacific. So areas between the Aleutians, Kamchatka, the Kuriles, down through Japan. We just got smacked. And so you've seen the old images from Hilo, the whole town of Shitamachi is just wiped out. Similar damage on Oahu, things we've seen in Kauai and even in, I think, Molokai. So kind of that impetus was where our warning sirens got to be used.
And so we've actually, I know on the conversation, Catherine, there have been segments in partnership with the Center of Oral History who have talked about what it was like to survive that tsunami and how devastating it was. And it just really illustrated the need for Hawaii to work together with other locations in the Pacific to have some sort of warning system. So as Khan explained, we refined that throughout a number of years. And we released our first evacuation maps, so maps that show you what happens in the case of a tsunami if you are good where you are or if you need to go inland in the 1990s. But shortly after those were created, researchers and state officials said we need to reevaluate those maps because of a couple of incredibly serious disasters in the early and mid-2000s. Catherine, you might remember this as well as listeners. There was an earthquake and tsunami in the Indian Ocean in 2004 that killed over 220,000 people across 14 countries. It's one of the most deadly natural disasters recorded in history. And then in Japan in 2011, there was a massive tsunami that killed many people and destroyed several towns. And both of those disasters were caused by earthquakes with magnitudes larger than 9.0. which are extremely rare events. They happen only once in thousands of years.
Yeah, and I know everybody's worried that, you know, we might see something here and it could have terrible consequences like we saw, you know, back in the 1940s.
Exactly. But the maps that we had built in the 1990s were only based on the written historical record that we had for tsunamis that we've experienced really over the last 100, 200 years. So we hadn't accounted for one of these like once in a thousand year type type earthquakes that could cause a tsunami that would absolutely just devastate the islands. So officials wanted to be prepared, and they worked with scientists who looked at the geological record in order to prepare us for that worst case scenario. I got to talk to researcher Kwok Fai Chung, who was part of the team that developed the new models for Hawaii's revamped maps. And this is what he said the worst case scenario would be.
The worst case scenario for Hawaii would be a great Aleutian earthquake with magnitude over 9.0. Historically, we don't have that scenario because we only have 200 years of record for Hawaii and also for the U.S. But I have been working with geologists, so they would dig holes in the coastal area to find marine sand deposits. So they actually found several layers of deposit below the Earth's surface. And they chased the deposits to tsunamis generated by large earthquake in the Aleutian Islands. So they have data going back to about 2,000 years.
Yeah, interesting. So it's possible.
Yeah. It certainly is possible, and we have much more information about that now, and that body of work is continuing to grow. But if you go to our emergency management websites, and you look at our evacuation zones now for Honolulu County, Kauai County, and Maui County, you'll see that they reflect a new extreme circumstance. So they'll see how far do you need to evacuate if we're getting an earthquake like ones that we saw in the 20th century, and how far would you need to evacuate in an extreme disaster situation. So they're a lot more comprehensive, but Sean said that even those maps might be outdated in the next 10 or 15 years because of sea level rise. So now we have to look to both the past and the future to understand what the threats are. And some agencies are already taking sea level rise into account. So Sean said he's working with the State Department of Transportation on their harbor master plan for 2050, because they want to know if we're going to build new facilities, would they be safe in the instance of a tsunami that's been exacerbated by sea level rise. But it's something that a lot of organizations, in Chun's view, need to start taking more seriously.
Oh, yeah. And I remember when we had the one tsunami here, and there was gridlock on the roadways and the highways because people were trying to get out of harm's way.
Absolutely. And so Laura Kahn said, you know, this is Tsunami Awareness Month. It's a great opportunity to go out and check those maps to know whether or not you are in an evacuation zone. Even if you're not in an evacuation zone, it's important to check, because if you can stay put, then you should, to try to leave those roadways and evacuation routes open for people who need to escape. And she said, you know, you want to prepare in advance because these things can happen very quickly. Here's Connor again.
The tsunamis don't happen, but when they do happen, they can cause a lot of damage and very quickly. You know, it's not like a hurricane where our weather service can give you a week's notice and then 72 hours and then a day and then 12 hours. These tsunamis, you know, if they're local, they're going to be on you and over in a couple hours. If they're from the Aleutians, they're going to hit you in 4 hours. If they're from Chile, it might take you 15 hours. But there's not a lot of time to think, so you want to plan ahead. That's just the best thing we can do. It doesn't take that long. And so when it does happen, we're not all a lot of adrenaline and concern for loved ones.
Yeah, I mean, you know, we used to have those maps, in the telephone books, right? But a lot of folks don't have those anymore. You've got to go online.
Yes. Unfortunately, they are available online. So if you go to the Department of Defense website, they're available there, as well as the website for the Pacific Disaster Center. And it'll have additional information you need about how to prepare.
Yep. All very good information to know about. Like now, so you know how to react. But thanks so much, Savannah.
Thank you, Catherine. Take care.
That was HBR Savannah Harriman-Pote talking with us about how the reality of rising sea levels means a greater threat of damage from tsunamis. This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. A flock of four nene recently surprised wildlife experts by showing up in Southern California. It's basically unheard of for our state bird to take a trip to California, but did you know you can spot California's state bird in Hawaii? We now go to this week's Manu Minute. University of Hawaii at Hilo Professor Patrick Hart introduces us to the California quail.
California quail are native to the west coast of North America and were first introduced to Hawaii way back in 1818 as a gift from a ship captain to King Kamehameha I. By the end of the 1800s, quail had expanded and become common across all the main Hawaiian islands. Like many other game bird introductions to Hawaii, their numbers declined for a variety of reasons, including hunting, predators, particularly mongoose, and possibly disease, to the point where they're now rare on all islands except for the Big Island, where they're still fairly common. California quail are only about 10 inches long from the tip of their tail to their bill, and are known for their distinct curled black topknot on their head that's made up of 6 feathers that droop forward. The males are particularly striking, with a bluish-gray breast and back, with white streaks and chestnut-colored cap on their head. California quail are mostly found in higher elevation grasslands and woodlands on Mauna Kea and Mauna Loa, where they feed on a variety of seeds of both native and introduced plant species, also leaves and insects. They lay about 12 to 16 eggs in a nest, and similar to chickens, their young are known as precocial, meaning the babies are able to follow their parents and forage for food within minutes after hatching. One way to find California quail is by their call, which sounds a bit like Chicago, Chicago. You can typically find quail in big flocks, known as coveys, on the ground. But if they're startled, they'll loudly burst into flight all at once, making them very popular with hunters. For Hawaii Public Radio, this is Patrick Hart from the UH Hilo Department of Biology.
Support for Manu Minute comes from Hawaii Forest and Trail, exploring Hawaii Island with visitors and kama'aina for more than 30 years. More information at hawaii-forest.com.
And now it's time for the answer to today's backyard quiz. Earlier, we dug into the history of Alamoana Beach Park. It started as a wetland garbage dump about a century ago and has since morphed into a popular hangout for locals and visitors. We were looking for the official name of what nearly everyone simply refers to as Magic Island. The man-made peninsula was built on reclaimed land with the original intent of becoming a private resort. Developers came up with the familiar name and intended for it to be the first of three in a large resort hotel complex. Unfortunately for the developers, but fortunately for the public, the project fell through after Magic Island was constructed. The state was left with a 30-acre peninsula, which opened as a public park in 1964, an extension of Ala Moana Beach. A few years later, in 1972, perhaps intending to avoid confusing the public by calling it an island, the state announced the peninsula's new name. And while Aina Moana, or the land from the sea, maybe the name on the books, it's a good bet that most folks will continue to call it Magic Island. Thanks to Mark Sakamoto for today's quiz, and congrats to Christy from Maui. You are a winner. You had the fastest fingers. Have an idea for a quiz you'd like to share? Write to TalkBack at hawaiipublicradio.org. We have to go now. Up tomorrow, the University of Hawaii celebrates 100 years of kabuki. We learn more about the Japanese performing art and its influences in pop culture. Leave your feedback on our TalkBack line, 808-792-8217, or email TalkBack at hawaiipublicradio.org. You can find our archive shows online by searching for The Conversation on our website or anywhere you tune in for podcasts. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for more of The Conversation.